This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, he didn't just write about dogs. We'll take a look at the radical Jack London.
London's book, The Iron Heel, is almost predictive of what we see happening in this country and world today. It's the 100th anniversary, but it could be happening now.
We'll also speak with Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles about a program that may turn local police into domestic counterterrorism agents. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Local police may be finding themselves on the front lines of domestic counterterrorism if a program launched recently by the Los Angeles Police Department is adopted in other large cities. Since 9/11, the government has tried to engage local police in doing counterterrorism work for them, collecting so-called street-level intelligence about suspicious activities that might predict another attack. So far, it hasn't worked out that way. But an LAPD official has devised a possible solution that the LA Times calls, quote, so cheap, so easy to implement, and so innovative that officials in D.C. are thinking of making it a national model for all police departments. Joining me today is Jim Lafferty, Executive Director of the Los Angeles National Lawyers Guild, to talk about the implications of having local police become intelligence officers. Jim Lafferty, welcome once again to Law and Disorder.
Ah, good to be with you.
Now, Jim, tell us your thoughts about what they're calling an innovative plan. Is this going to make us safer? What new intelligence gathering breakthrough is this really?
Well, as I think you indicated in your introduction, they've been trying to get local police officers on the beat ever since 9/11 to all become little counterintelligence spies and counterintelligence gathering agents. It's always been very impractical and hard to do from a financial point of view, too complicated, I guess, a lot of local authorities thought. So here, somebody in L.A. has come up with a way to make it simple. Simple, of course, is always dangerous. They've reduced it to a kind of a checklist, if you will, and it's basically a 64-item checklist. I think you and your listeners will be rather surprised at some of the items on it. These are items, in other words, that should alert local law enforcement officers that there may be a terrorist attack or a terrorist agent in their midst. One of them says, does the individual appear to engage in counter-surveillance efforts? And, of course, they define that by doubling back in their car or changing directions and so forth.
Evasive driving. That could describe any driver in L.A. or New York.
Yeah, well, certainly in L.A., I know that's for sure. And it gets worse, of course. I mean, you know, they go on to talk about how if you take pictures of public buildings, they don't appear to have aesthetic value. Well, tourists are always taking pictures, of course, of public buildings. Whether they have aesthetic value or not often depends upon whether it's a professional photographer or just a tourist like you and I taking pictures. Who's to say, after all, what constitutes something with aesthetic value?
Right, and I know that even in New York, before these 64 items were issued, I've heard stories of tourists and New Yorkers who like to take pictures being stopped and asked why they're photographing a building. I mean, we're in a city with some of the most beautiful buildings in the world.
We're defending a case like that right now. There's actually here an amateur photographer who's very good. He's at art shows and likes to take images at sunrise, interesting industrial buildings. And that's exactly what he was doing. And he got arrested for doing it because one of the images that he was catching as he took this picture was a oil refinery, you know. Legal observers, as you well know, of the National Lawyers Guild, our legal observers often take photos and videos at large demonstrations. Are we going to be suspected of engaging in counterterrorism or terrorism activity if we do that? It's silly.
It is silly. And I guess a concern that I have is that by reducing to a list of 64 items, the government seems to feel safe that they can be now converting local police who are trained in a certain way to act as intelligent gatherers. And we know that there's a special expertise, long years of training, that goes into real intelligence. And I think for me, one of the problems that we've seen over the last few years is the government over-collecting information, be it emails, recording individuals who are at protests trying to gather political information, storing them, and then not really being able to sift through and analyze because we don't have enough personnel and the means to actually do that. This is going to add yet another layer of 64 items that I can see just becoming a nightmare if the local police does indeed try to start enforcing this.
Well, you hit on a very good point. In fact, as we know from the investigations after 9/11, all sorts of information was available. The point is, as the phrase was, that nobody was connecting those collected dots. The idea that we're now going to have thousands of more dots at a local police department, which is already as busy as it can be. We're here in L.A. trying to protect everyday crimes that are going on in the streets of our city. The notion that somehow with a modicum of training, and I can assure you that's all this the order of the chief calls for, are going to somehow be able to collect meaningful data and then, as you point out, analyze it. And the local police department is charged with that responsibility. I mean, I've talked to local police officers, and they know this is ridiculous. They know this is something that isn't going to be done. What is going to happen is that an awful lot of us are going to find ourselves on more lists. One of the items, for example, on this 64-item checklist, does an individual seem to have an interest in the travel itinerary of public officials, you know?
Right.
Well, all of the protest groups here in L.A. always want to know when George Bush is coming to town, when Dick Cheney is coming to town, when the candidates are coming to town. We engage in all sorts of perfectly legal efforts through their campaign offices or what have you to find out their itinerary, to find out their travel schedule so that we can greet them along the way with our protest signs. That would clearly get you on the list now of the LAPD.
That is of concern because that information is basically public and any good protester knows that you have to be one step ahead of the game to be there, plan a protest before the individual gets to town. But I got to tell you, one that really got to me was number 7, abandons vehicle in a secured or restricted location like the airport or a sports venue. I mean, how many times in picking someone up at the airport have you had to double park your car, run in to find the person? But a sports game, you're picking up your nephew from a softball game. And
No, of course, you're absolutely right. All of these are open to interpretation. Obviously, there are some on the list. Somebody buying large quantities of explosives, you know.
Right.
All right, somebody's buying large quantities of explosives. I suppose we should certainly know about that. But most of the items are subject to this kind of very subjective way of looking at it by people who, as we've already pointed out, local officers aren't going to be that well trained to begin with. And the other part of this that I find really offensive is that an anonymous individual, these items don't have to have been observed by a police officer here in L.A., an anonymous individual can see something which to her or him looks suspicious, and they have no training at all, of course, report it to the police. The police must dutifully take it down. If the person reporting it wishes to be anonymous under this law, under this rule now here in L.A., they can remain anonymous. And nevertheless, your report on your activity is then given to a whole bunch of policing agencies, including the criminal task force. Your name is then on a list of a possible criminal, et cetera, et cetera. It's really draconian.
That's what the definition of suspicious activity report, which is the report they're going to be using to document any reported or observed activity, it does say that it may be reported either by observations or investigation of police, or, as you've said,
by private parties. Now, that's kind of like the campaign that we've had here in New York on the subways. If you see something, say something. It's essentially turning private parties into uninformed informants.
Yeah.
It may just be because they see something that doesn't fit into their notion of how things are done or seems different to them. That's very dangerous.
Well, we know for a fact, you and I and other groups like us around the country, that people who harbor a prejudice against, for example, Muslims, people wearing headscarves, people wearing religious clothing, who may be engaging in an activity that is perfectly innocent, but to the prejudiced viewer, aha, that must be another one of those people planning a terrorist attack, you know. Next thing you know, they're on a list. In fact, one of the first individuals here to call this to our attention is the man that is the head of the Shura Council. The Shura Council is the coalition, if you will, of all of the Islamic mosques in Southern California. They're very concerned about this because this lends itself so clearly to racial profiling. And but I was thinking as I'm looking over the list here as we talk, I've been in the Guild office, and I haven't been in the national office in the last few months, I guess. But last time I was there, you have some posters up on the wall that might get you into this list.
You bet I do. Posters of heroes of not only me, but of many in the Guild. We won't name names, but if we had a visit by a local law enforcement official and they were trying to look for people to put on the list, we'd be added to that list.
Yeah, because one of the items is, does somebody espouse or give support to terrorists?
Well, it even says posters of terrorist leaders, displays overt support of known terrorist networks.
Yeah, so you got a poster up somewhere of Che Guevara, and if the man involved or the individual involved thinks he's a terrorist or was a terrorist, I should say, you're on the list.
Many of our members would be on the list.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention, because earlier you said that, of course, possession of illicit materials, biologic agents like anthrax and other things are clearly on the list. But what was a bit troublesome to me is that number 11 says makes or attempts to make suspicious purchase, such as a large amount of otherwise legal materials like pool chemicals or fertilizers.
Yes.
I mean, Jim, there goes the pool. There goes the lawn.
Yeah.
That's, to me, a little bit much.
Well, of course, of course. Somebody goes and buys it. Because what is a large amount? You've been to my house. I happen to have a very large back area behind my house. Should I choose to fertilize it, I would be buying an amount of fertilizer greater than most of my neighbors. Is that going to get me on the list? I mean, you know, the question you asked at the beginning, I think, of our talk this morning is any of this going to make us safer? I don't know. I find it hard to understand how sparsely trained, already overworked local police officials working in cooperation with anonymous sources on a list as subjective as this, and having the duty now of maintaining yet more files on people, is going to make us safer. I think it's more than a slippery slope. I think it's a waste of our tax dollars. It is a slippery slope in terms of eroding our rights to privacy, to go about our political life without having every action that we engage in that may be contrary to the interest of the Bush administration being viewed as somehow subversive or possibly indicative of a terrorist strain in our bloodstream or something. Like the Patriot Act and like almost every executive order that's come out post 9/11 and the acts that have been passed by Congress, they're designed, I think, in the main to protect the ruling elite in this country from those of us who would protest their war policies or their domestic policies. I don't think they're designed to make us safer from terrorist attacks. And I can't see how this could be. And the one or two, and I haven't done a study of it, but the one or two rather high-ranking police officers that I've had a chance to chat with already about this here in L.A. are very skeptical about it as well. And yet, it looks like it's going to be the wave of the future. They're talking about making this national now, Heidi.
Well, in fact, Police Chief William Bratton, formerly of our own NYPD here,
indeed,
is extremely enthusiastic about this program. I read that he just loves using statistics and standardized reporting to analyze and combat crime trends. And after the LAPD consulted with officials in Washington, Bratton issued a special order this last March, formally requiring all officers to report incidents, quote, potentially related to foreign or domestic terrorism, using this program designed by police official named McNamara. Mm-hmm. Now, also, I believe Bratton has gotten the attention of the U.S. Directorate of National Intelligence with this program. In April, it sent teams of experts to Boston and Chicago to see if the LAPD program can be implemented in those cities and get this as a model to much greater expansion.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, I think this is the wave of the future, I'm afraid. I'm very pleased that your program is calling some attention to it. It's very new. Some of our lawyers here are just beginning to look at it to see to what extent it's constitutionally overbroad and therefore unconstitutional, to what extent people would have recourse if they find themselves on the list, to what extent this can be challenged. But like so many of these things, the way that I think is most effective to challenge them, frankly, is to talk about them, to protest them in the streets, to not let them make us afraid to speak up, to ridicule them when they deserve to be ridiculed, and to challenge them when they deserve to be challenged, and not let this kind of repressive cloak of fear settle over the country, which, as I say, I think is designed in the main not to protect us, but to protect the government from those of us who would find fault with its policies.
Jim, did you know that the FBI has been given permission in L.A. to legally engage in non-criminal surveillance based on ethnic profiling?
Yeah, I did. And that's very controversial here as well. And I'm glad you mentioned that because I think, you know, when we go back and look at the COINTEL programs of the FBI in the late 60s and early 70s, and those programs started off initially as data gathering, evidence gathering, intelligence gathering programs, and quickly became programs in which agents of the FBI would infiltrate perfectly legal political groups, try to disrupt their activities, try to seed dissension within the groups, and often try to seduce the groups into engaging in illegal activity when that hadn't been their intention at all. And this new 64-item checklist, this new order from the LA Chief of Police, coupled with what you've just said about the FBI, wrap it all together, and basically what you've got, again, is COINTELPRO. You've got spying on legal activity.
One of the things that you mentioned about the so-called chilling effect that this type of new policy will have is that when individuals hear about it, they may curb their activities out of fear. And we've seen that with the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is so confusing and vague in its language that animal rights and environmental rights activists really aren't sure what activity is legal and what isn't. And I think that this and other laws that are being brought forth and that really play on the public sphere by using the word terrorist, one of the greatest side effects is that they are chilling free speech.
Yeah. Let's say, for example, to use what we just talked about this morning, I go and I buy those rather large amounts of fertilizer, and I don't buy it from my regular gardening place, and maybe I'm a Muslim to boot. And they think, my God, what's that guy want with all that fertilizer? And so they report me. I find myself on this list. The police are charged under Bratton's order with investigating some of these things. Somebody knocks on my door, a police officer knocks on my door, and say, we understand you just bought, you know, huge 20 bags of fertilizer. What's that all about? And I explain it. And he says, well, okay, fine. But now I'm thinking to myself, my God, there's a demonstration next week. I guess they got their eye on me. I mean, I better not go. I mean, should I go? Why? You know, that's the chilling. If that's what chilling effect means, it's not some kind of vague concept. People really do react to that. We can't expect everybody in this country to be willing to be a hero, to be willing to stand up to the FBI individually if they think that every move they're going to make is now going to keep them on a list, make them more suspicious, especially if they're of an ethnic group or religious group that is already under the watchful eye of our government anyway.
Well, that brings us to our closing question, Jim. What should people do?
You know, we are going to look at whether this can be challenged in the courts. I don't know the answer to that yet. Whether this can be challenged, you know, by way of some of the political movements around town that protest these things regularly. Certainly there will be protest about it. But I always say that the most effective thing that any individual or group of individuals could do these days in this country, as their lawyers are suing in court, is to exercise the rights they're trying to squelch, to not be afraid to go to the demonstration, to not be afraid to buy the fertilizer if you need the fertilizer, to not be afraid to find out when the president's going to be in town and what his travel route may be so that you can line the streets with protest, to exercise the rights so that you don't lose them, and in doing so to let the government know that they cannot intimidate you out of doing that simply by passing this make work for police officers, which won't make us safer anyway.
Jim, we couldn't have said it better here, and we really thank you for your insights about this new policy that originated out of your hometown.
Yeah. Thank you, Heidi. Thank you. It's wonderful. Always good to be on the wonderful show.
And we'll talk to you later.
Thank you, dear.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org
for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Several radio stations around the country have started to carry Law and Disorder. We'd like to acknowledge these stations. WHYS, Eau Claire Community Radio, 96.3 FM, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho. WFRN, Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM. KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP, Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM. KRFC, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT, 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Two stations in Alaska, KWMD, 90.7 in Kasilof, Radio Anchorage at 104.5 FM in Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton, Massachusetts, KIF FM 100.4 FM in Enid, Oklahoma, 1640 AM station in Front Royal, Virginia, Moton Community House Radio Online, and ISPCA Radio, that's the Indiana Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, broadcasting worldwide from Indiana. And last, from Asheville, North Carolina, WPVM 103.5 FM, the progressive voice of the mountains.
Thanks to all of our affiliates.
And their listeners. The Iron Heel, written by Jack London, was one of the first dystopian novels chronicling a growing police state in the United States. A part of The Iron Heel has been excerpted in the newly published anthology called The Radical Jack London, edited by Jonah Raskin. London was America's leading revolutionary writer at the turn of the 20th century. Today we're joined in the studio by Jonah Raskin, and we'll examine comparisons of what London sets forth in his novel, The Iron Heel, to what has happened in the United States since 9/11. Jonah is a professor and chair of communication studies at Sonoma State University. He's also the author of America's Scream, Allen Ginsberg, Howell, and the Making of the Beat Generation. Jonah, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
You've written this just marvelous introduction to the radical Jack London and included in the anthology of Jack London's work, stuff that's never or rarely seen.
Yes.
You're to be thanked and congratulated for it. Jack London, as listeners may know, was a lifelong socialist at the turn of the century. He wrote a great prophetic novel of what American police state would look like called The Iron Heel back in 1908. So we are celebrating the 100th anniversary of Jack London's great novel. We want to talk to you today about Jack London, The Iron Heel, and how you see what he wrote 100 years ago as pertaining to what's going on now, particularly since 9/11. Tell our listeners a little bit about Jack London, who he was, not just a writer of dog stories.
Yes, unfortunately, Jack London has come to be memorialized as the author of The Call of the Wild and White Fang, those two dog stories, and he wrote so much else. He wrote more than 50 books, and he was profoundly political, and he was involved with all of the major political struggles of his day. He was born in San Francisco in 1876. He died in 1916 at the age of 40. He came from a family that was in poverty, and so he grew up identifying with the down and out of people who didn't have a place to live or enough food. When he was a teenager, he left home and traveled across the country as a hobo and a tramp. And years later, he wrote a book about that experience called The Road. So every place he went, and this was a formative experience, he had to watch out for police and people in law enforcement, and also the men who worked for the railroads, because they were arresting people like this who were traveling across country, who didn't have jobs, who weren't employed. So he saw America when he traveled across the country from the point of view of the outcast from the American dream, from people who didn't have jobs, people who didn't have money. And then what happened when he got to Erie County, New York, which he was really thought was going to happen at any time when he was traveling, was that he was arrested and he was put in the Erie County Penitentiary. That was also a very searing experience in his life, to see what life was like on the inside of a prison, the brutality, just the dehumanization of human beings that takes place in prison. And he also wrote about that in his memoir, The Road, which was published in 1907 and inspired the other Jack Kerouac, to write On the Road. And when Jack Kerouac was 18 years old, he read Jack London and he said, "I want to be like this guy. I want to go on the road. I want to have adventures." And he did. So I see Jack London as a really pivotal figure in American literature. He carried on the traditions of Mark Twain, Herman Melville, and he also initiated a lot of the literature of the 20th century, and people like Sinclair Lewis went on to take up the threads that he'd begun, and also Norman Mailer and Ernest Hemingway. You know, that Jack London, when he came back from traveling across the country to Oakland in 1895, he joined the Socialist Party. For the next 10 years, he was profoundly connected to the cause of socialism in the United States. And he spoke about socialism widely. He saw himself as a propagandist. He was proud of being a propagandist. And he also saw him as an artist. Those were probably the two of the main ists that he was: socialist, artist, propagandist, and wanted propaganda to be art. George Orwell, who was also inspired by Jack London when he wrote 1984, another dystopian novel, said that all art is propaganda, but not all propaganda is art. And I think that that does fit Jack London.
You did the book, it's called The Road, right, that London did?
Yes, correct.
That was 1907?
Yes.
And then right after that, he wrote The Iron Heel?
Yes.
1908. And
yes.
Why don't you give us some sense of what is the Iron Heel is, what's its thesis, what's its driving force?
All right. Well, it is presented as the memoirs of a woman who is intimately involved with the revolution, who's writing her memoirs. There's a preface by a fictional character who describes how this memoir is discovered hundreds of years into the future, and it describes how the forces of revolution were crushed and how this oligarchy, a small, powerful elite, came to control and dominate American society. So from the late 1890s, Jack London was in two minds, and he was very often a divided fellow. He said, I'm not sure whether we're going to have socialism around the world or we're going to have autocratic and dictatorship. So the key event for him was 1905, the year of the first Russian Revolution, which was brutally crushed by the Tsar and forces allied with the Tsar. And so that tipped the balance for Jack London, so that he was, to him, that was gloomy sense of what was going to happen. And he'd also had traveled around the United States in 1905. He gave a speech called Revolution, which he gave first at the University of California at Berkeley, all across the country, then at Harvard and at Yale. He also gave the speech to bankers and businessmen who were curious to meet him because he was the best-selling author in America. And they said, you think you're going to have a revolution. Well, I'm sorry to say, we're going to crush you. We're going to stamp on your face. So he thought that socialism was something, to him it looked like inevitable, natural. I mean, how could you be opposed to a society of like equality and a society would provide opportunity for everybody, no matter what their class background was? And then so to hear these bankers and saying, you know, we'll never allow this to happen, it was really a rude awakening, a wake-up call to him. And he was very much influenced beginning in 1900 and for the next, until 1906 or 1907, by Anna Strunsky, who was born in Russia, who was Jewish, who was socialist, who came to the United States and to San Francisco with her family. And Jack London met her in December of 1899 and fell in love with her. And in addition to reading, he read all of the classics of socialism and Marxism, including Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto.
What else did he read?
Oh, he read LaSalle, he read the anarchist author, he read Das Kapital, and he urged people to read Das Kapital. But certainly the Communist Manifesto is this pivotal work where the idea that there are classes in American society, and even in his day, there were people going around saying this is a classless society. We're all the same here.
Everybody's middle class.
Yes. So he pointed out that there were people who didn't have anything. There were the haves and the have-nots, and that there was also class warfare. It wasn't all peaceful. And so, I mean, there were also really profound labor struggles that were going on of organizing the unorganized in factories, in miners.
And I guess both of those minds come out in The Iron Heel, but
yes, well, The Iron Heel is a novel. It's told by one of the revolutionaries who is married to a comrade and a fellow revolutionary named Ernest Everhart. The revolutionary forces are growing, and at the same time, the counter-revolutionary forces of the oligarchy are building themselves up. The oligarchs, this small, wealthy group of people, have the army at their disposal, they have the police at their disposal, and they're doing everything secretly. They're conspiring to put an end to democracy. There's the veil of freedom or the illusion of freedom and the First Amendment and democracy. And London points out in the novel that the democratic process has really been degraded. There are lobbyists and there are backroom deals that are being made, and the political parties, the people with clout in the political parties are ruling the society and determining the fate of citizens, not the citizens themselves.
You mention in the book and in your reviews of it the kinds of repression that were going on during in the novel.
Yes. Okay. Well, people who are speaking out and condemning the society are arrested and put in jail. There's also the use of psychology as a weapon of labeling people insane or crazy and locking them up. And London is saying, well, sometimes those people are speaking the most clearly and rationally about what's going on in the society. So there is psychological warfare that's going on against the whole citizenry. I mean, London says it's a time of madness and insanity when you look at the society, the kinds of things that are going on. I know I look at our society today and it seems like it's crazy what happens.
What do you mean by that?
Going about our ordinary daily life and putting my pants on and going to work. But I think about the war in Iraq and what's happening in Afghanistan every day and the insanity that there's this criminal, immoral war going on. I mean, it drives me crazy, really.
The Iron Heel has not gone out of print, correct?
That is right. It has been in print for 100 years. It was not popular when it first came out because, for the most part, people in the Socialist Party and the Socialist Movement thought socialism is going to happen in the United States. It's just around the corner. And so London's saying, no, I don't really think it's going to be happening here. If you want my opinion, there's going to be dictatorship and police and military rule and not democratic socialism. So I think it bears saying that Jack London believed that socialism was a system that would lead to both economic and social equality, and that it would lead to democracy. And the socialism that he wanted was the socialism of equality, that people who would have a chance to go to school, to learn, to get out of poverty. He had been a child laborer. He had experienced the ravages of capitalism firsthand as a boy and as a child, because his own parents had sent him off to work in mills and factories and then to take his wages. So he knew what that was like. He was absolutely opposed to child labor. And he really did. He really did know what the life of working men and working women was like all around this country. And he had the facts and he had the figures. He could quote all kinds of numbers. But he also, he humanized socialism. He put a human face to it. A lot of the socialists, when he first became involved, were immigrants. They were from Germany. They still largely spoke German. They were thinking about revolution in European terms. And Jack London Americanized it. He talked the same language of working men and working women. He happened to be extraordinarily handsome and good-looking. He looked like he could have been Marlon Brando's older brother. He looked like a matinee idol. People followed him around. He had charisma. And he wrote about his own experiences, for example, How I Became a Socialist, where he told his own experience. And a lot of people at that time were talking about sort of impersonal forces, the market and the economy. And he showed where he had come from and that he had been a fierce individualist. He'd believed that if you worked hard and you exerted yourself, that you could get ahead in the society. And he saw that that didn't happen. He felt like the only salvation was to be solidarity, to join together with other people in order to make effective change.
He was in the left wing of the Socialist Party, around the Wobblies, around Eugene V. Debs, wasn't he?
Yes. He came to identify with the Wobblies, with the industrial workers of the world, and became an admirer of Big Bill Haywood. And there were Haywood and some of the other Wobblies were arrested and secretly transported by railroad car from Colorado to Idaho. They got somebody to testify, somebody who had been a police informant for years. They made a deal with him to testify against the Wobblies, to make up this case against them that they were accused of assassinating a former governor. Eugene Debs called it the trial of the century. It pitted the bosses of capitalism against the working class. And Theodore Roosevelt got involved in it and said these men are guilty and they should be sent to jail. It was in all the media. It was a cause celebre, and Jack London got involved and wrote about it and spoke about it and said it's a conspiracy on the part of the wealthy mine owners and the political figures in the West to crush the organized labor and prevent the union from organizing.
It's almost like a swan song to socialism in a way. It's almost like the end, I mean, for him. Because then the next 8 years, he dies 8 years later, but he goes off to his ranch in Northern California and
yes.
lives out his life. And
yes.
So is he, and he said, and he knew his socialist friends would be angry at him, apparently. So is he really saying, look, I don't think we can win? What's he really saying? That the repression is too great?
Let's not underestimate the power of capital, the economic and political and social, as a global system, and the force of repression. I think that there will be socialism sometime in the future. There will be world socialism, but it's very far away. Wake up to that. So he did. It is a swan song to socialism. London was very, he was loath to give up anything once he had begun it. So he didn't actually resign from the Socialist Party until 8 months before he died in 1916. He continued to be friends with socialists. I would say he drifted away from red revolution or political revolution to a kind of green revolution and back to the land. There was a back to the land movement at that time in California, and he was building green architecture and experimenting with organic farming. But the members of the Industrial Workers of the World came to his place. He invited people there. He was, to a large extent, living a bourgeois life. He was making a lot of money, and he was buying all kinds of things. He was living what Thorsten Veblen called the life of conspicuous consumption. In his defense, he said, I'm a kind of Robin Hood. I'm stealing from the rich, and I'm giving to my working class friends. Anna Strunsky said that he wanted to beat the capitalists at their own game. He wanted to outdo them and show that a socialist could be better at marketing and sales than they themselves.
What do you think he would say today about where we are in the United States today? The Bush administration, the wars, Obama, anybody? What would he be thinking?
He'd be very interested in what was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. So he did, at the end of the Iron Heel, write about terrorism, and he did write about torture. So people say, well, how is it that he wrote about torture in like 1907? Well, there's a long history of torture in civilization, and certainly going back to the Inquisition. He was aware of the use of torture in the Boer War, right around the turn of the century, and the use of torture to get information. And he was outraged by the use of torture. So terrorism for him was not the way to go. He did believe, I would say that to a large extent, that Jack London, for most of his life, he believed in legal change. And he thought that it was the socialists, he would say, by and large, were lawful. It was the capitalist class and the military and the police who were breaking the law. And he said, we have a great constitution. If we could get the people to follow the constitution and adhere to the law, we'd be a lot better off than we are. He had friends who were anarchists, including Alexander Berkman, who was Emma Goldman's lover. And he felt tremendous solidarity and sympathy with the anarchists. Anytime an anarchist was arrested and in jail, he would defend them. But he didn't believe in the anarchist tactics as a way to change society. He said, well, you assassinate Frick or you assassinate a president, one person, they'll just put somebody else in power. That he was saying you have to change the whole system. He also did see in his own day the kind of religious crusading movements of fundamentalism and the religious right, of people using religion as a way to cajole and badger people, and the religious sects. He thought that they was very harmful to and also disruptive to a democratic society. So in those ways, I think that he would have been alarmed at the Christian right in this country. I think he probably also would have been alarmed by the sort of Islamic fundamentalist.
We're talking to Jonah Raskin, the editor of a new amazing book called The Radical Jack London, Writings on War and Revolution. If you want to learn more about Jack London, if you want to read an excerpt from the Iron Heel.
Put out by the University of California Press. It just came out. I finished the long, wonderful introduction just yesterday. And Jonah Raskin, really congratulations for doing this. It's an excellent collection. Really intelligent introduction by someone who, what I would say, is a comrade of Jack London's. And that's the biggest compliment.
Yeah, the introduction is amazing. The Iron Heel never actually came to an ending, right? The woman protagonist breaks off in the middle of her sentence?
Yes.
And why is that?
Because she's been writing and the police come in and arrest her.
Oh, so, I didn't realize that. Okay.
So I like it because it gives this sort of ominous feeling that, you know, at any time the police can come in and take you away, and she does have time to hide the manuscript, yes. So I also like it that it breaks off in mid-sentence. It makes me feel like the sort of the unfinished quality about history. History is, we haven't written the end of history yet. It's ongoing, it's continuing. You ask about today and the elections, So Jack London would say, well, you know, we don't really live in a democracy. We live in a republic. We need to have popular referendums so people can vote on the issues of the day. He also believed in the recall. If politicians get into office and they're doing things other than what they promised, we have the right to take them out of power. We should be able to vote them out, even as we voted them in. He was very conflicted. I mean, he did see the ways that masses of people conformed to the dominant society. You know, at the end of his life there, and also, well, in the Iron Heel, he puts his faith in a small group of cadre revolutionaries. People have said, you know, the Russian Revolution, he died the year before the Russian Revolution. If he had lived, he might very well have turned into a Bolshevik. And John Reed, who wrote Insurgent Mexico and 10 Days That Shook the World, did carry on one of Jack London's legacies, which was to get involved in revolution and to write that kind of masterpiece of revolution in 10 Days That Shook the World. No.
Well, the entire left wing of the American Socialist Party supported the Russian Revolution, particularly Debs. And I wouldn't be surprised, had Jack London lived, that he would have been in that camp.
Yes, yes. In addition to being a political novel with lots and lots of ideas. And one last thing maybe also to say about what's something that I think reverberates with the Bush people. Jack London's, the people, the oligarchs in his book, believe that they're doing good. They have a sense of righteousness. And that is also my take on the Bush people, that they, in the name of good and righteousness and defending civilization, they're bombing populations and torturing people, but they really think that they're protecting civilization. But it's also a love story. Now, Jack London was always interested in reaching masses of people, a lot of readers, and so he's written this political novel as a love story, and he has a woman telling the story in hopes that women readers who usually don't read political fiction and are not in the socialist movement will read this book and identify with this heroine. When he traveled around the United States in 1905, he talked about the economic and political reasons for joining the socialist movement. But when he was on college campuses, he also said to students, you want adventure, you want romance, you'll find it in the revolution. So in that sense, I think that he was also, many people in the 60s joined the revolution because of the excitement, youth, young people. It was a political adventure at that time.
The Radical Jack London, the subtitle is Writings on War and Revolution. It's a terrific anthology that our guest today, Jonah Raskin, has put together and introduced. Just a wonderful book, The Radical Jack London by Jonah Raskin. And Jonah, thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We'd like to thank our listeners for their generous pledges of support for our show, Law and Disorder, and for WBAI in New York City. Your pledges are the lifeblood of this station. A heartfelt thanks from all of us.